This is Everyday We're Hustling. I'm Miranda Campbell. More and more, young people are trying to turn their creative projects into careers. Getting this going involves struggle, commitment, and a whole lot of work. Everyday we're hustling. Our guests work in different creative fields, but what they have in common is this hustle. Pursuing a creative career means juggling artistic and economic demands. It's a constant balancing act, and the road to making a living isn't always clear. So, how are young people managing all this? This episode, we look at shifting gears and working in more than one artistic discipline. Many young people have talent and interest in a lot of different creative fields. Making a living from creative work often means diversifying your output, but this can also mean doubling your workload and finding your way in different kinds of business realities. How do you shift gears between these different roles? Does personal life even fit into the mix? Lito Pimienta is a visual artist, illustrator, musician, and mom. Originally from Barranquilla, Colombia, Lito now lives and works in Toronto. In addition to balancing art and music in her career, she's also an advocate for the fair treatment and compensation of women in the creative industries. Lito hosted a workshop called Get Your Coin Girl at X-Space Cultural Center in Toronto, instructing a mostly female audience on when to say no to unpaid gigs and how to get paid a fair rate. Hi, Lito. Thanks for joining us today. What do you tell people when they ask you, what do you do?
I tell them I'm an artist. Okay. I'm a curator. That's what I went to school for. I am a public speaker. You know, I give tons of art talks. So those are really good too, because, you know, you get to fly across Canada and share, you know, essentially what we're doing here today with students. So that's another thing that I do. Mm-hmm. And if they want to know more, then I'll go into specifics. But just to keep it simple, I just say I'm a multidisciplinary artist. Yeah. There's so much ground to explore. So I'm interested in all those things. But I also am very aware that it's not good to do four things at the same time, unless you have a team that is helping you with different things within that. But my advice is always, for people that are multi-talented, take it easy and do one thing at a time. And if you're doing, I mean, I do like four things at a time, but I know that Monday is for art, Tuesday is for booking shows, Wednesday is for creating work, you know, Thursday is for writing a new song, and so on and so on. Otherwise, you're going to go nuts.
Yeah. Do you work best when you block off a full day for one thing?
Yes.
Or so you're not going back and forth between two things in a day?
Yeah. I mean, I'm the kind of person that needs absolute focus. Even if I know that this one day I need to work on this painting, I know I can't even have people over unless they're coming to do the same thing and we can work next to each other in silence. But even that, you know, I am that serious about it. Even my guys, you know, when we have to rehearse, no one can bring a partner with them. They can't bring their girlfriend or can't bring a friend. This is work. So that's very important. And that doesn't happen enough.
Yeah. Business and social life is separate.
Completely.
And you try to maintain those boundaries.
Yes. You just got to have a schedule. Use technology to your advantage. Don't be afraid of it. Try as much as you can to stay focused and organized. Mm-hmm. That's how I've been able to do this for this long. Mm-hmm. I'm also a mom. So it's very important that I keep a good schedule and reminders. And I have all sorts of schedules. I have a wall that I drew with chalk, and I write down all of my things.
Is this in your house? You have a
in my art studio. And I also have four emails.
Okay.
I have four work emails. One is dedicated for my artwork. The other one is dedicated to my music stuff. The other one is management, and the other one is personal. I share each of my schedules with each of those emails.
How does mom life balance into that?
So my son is a daycare you know, until 6 p.m. from Monday to Friday. So everything that I have to get done needs to get done before 5:30. And because I know that past 5:30, unless I'm playing a show, no one is going to come visit. No one's going to have a studio visit. No one is going to do an interview. Nobody's going to come and ask for a session, whatever recordings that I have to get done for an artist in South America or Europe. I have to get it done before I have to go get my son. So, you know, this question always comes up when people are saying, how do you do it? How do you do it? How do you do it? I'm like, well, how does the TTC driver does it? Like, how does the whatever, like, churro seller, you know? It's like, this is the same. It applies to every woman that is working and has children. You organize yourself. In my case, I really have to thank my friends because they are my chosen family, you know? My son's pickup list at daycare, just like 15 people that I can rely on to go pick him up in case I'm running late, you know, starting with my bandmate, Kavesh. So yeah, you know, every woman that knows that she's going to be working and she has children, she makes it work. You know, more than money, children need time. And if you learn how to manage your time, you will be able to be a good parent.
Being a working mom sounds like it's heightened your need for schedule.
Yep.
Has it also changed the way you value your work in terms of getting paid and demanding to get paid fairly?
Absolutely. Absolutely. I don't take on jobs that are going to keep me away from my son and that are going to keep me away from buying the things that my son needs. It is great. I mean, it really makes you have a definite priority list, you know. For some people, it is hard. For some people, it's hard to let themselves go of, you know, their freedom to get wasted every weekend if they want to. But it definitely helps when, you know, I want to own my own house one day. And it's not going to happen if I just keep getting these gigs and not even question or ask for more money. You know, like if I get a gig for whatever, $500, but I know that I can get $1,500, why not ask for those $1,500? Oh, because I don't want them to think that I am a diva bitch. I'm sorry, but I know that my show deserves at least $1,500. How are we going to get there? How can we do that? And then it's the question, well, we can't do it. And then it's back to me.
And do you feel like that's something women in particular struggle with in the ways we are socialized to be friendly, to be personable?
There's just, you know, even emails. I think about the one talk that we did at Get Your Coin at X-Space. Don't write a professional email and then finish with 20 smiley emoji, you know, exclamation mark, you know, like you just lost respect right there. I mean, there will be people that will think it's cute and they will continue to work with you. But the majority of people will take advantage of you in the long run because you are not to be taken seriously because of that, which, you know, we always want to be more personable and we want to be more approachable, but you don't have to. Because it's business. That's what you have your friends and family for.
Mm-hmm.
I also have no problem with being super professional and cold. I think it's great. I see it as like character. Like, this is a character I'm playing, you know. It's just because I am super friendly and flamboyant and like I'm always laughing, you know. But I have to pay rent. I have to feed myself. I have very expensive taste. How am I going to get those next Rihanna shoes? I have to be professional. So,
have you always used this persona?
It started like a character and now I completely have embodied it. Because I started so young in this thing, you know, like I was performing live since I was 11 years old. And up until that point, you know, like I was a child. And I was touring and I was playing these shows in South America and I never saw the money. because I'm a child and the people around me probably knew, but they didn't think they needed to tell me. And my mother was working, so she wasn't around. My mom thought that, you know, Lito and her friends are playing shows. It's so nice. But no, actually, we're getting paid, but I'm not getting paid, and I am the draw for the show. And then that kept happening for the next 10, 15 years, right? Because I was still, you know, I'm 22. What the hell do I know about managing a royalties and none of that stuff? I wrote songs for people. Never saw the money. I went on tour, maybe had like $200 for myself. And I know that, you know, what was made from the tour was way more than that. And again, on my account.
Have you had to be self-sufficient out of necessity?
Yeah. Yeah, because I mean, I came to this country with no family. My mother lives in London, Ontario, so we were there together, but then I moved to Toronto and with my son, and that was it. I had to start from zero. So I just started figuring out things on my own and how to do it on my own. And because I did it on my own, by the time that, oh, I have all these other people that can help me, I don't even know how to ask for the help because I'm just so used to it being done by myself and on my own.
This is a new skill, learning to ask for help.
Yeah, for sure. Absolutely. And knowing who to ask, I think that is a big thing.
So your new record comes with an illustrated songbook. Is this also a way to encourage people to purchase your music in a digital world where we all expect music to be free?
Yep, absolutely. I do it because I want to do it because I am a visual artist and I like to have a physical object that has your artwork in it. But I also know that, you know, we need extra, we need the extra push to buy the music, you know. And the good thing about the illustrated book is that if I send the file, like the PDF, to these different galleries in South America and give them the money to get them printed there, this is how people are going to be able to purchase the album.
Your music can reach broader audiences.
Yeah, and they're going to do it through art. So I love record stores, but I also am aware that North America is not the only place in the world. North America is very lucky that, you know, capitalism has made an industry out of music that has been keeping record stores sustainable, but it isn't sustainable in Colombia to have a record store. It's not sustainable in other countries. You know, it's like the stuff that you get here, like it would be so expensive down there. So, and it is expensive because of the cost of creating a vinyl and the cost of creating a whatever edition of whatever numbers of CDs. So to me, I'm like, how can I make it accessible for people in South America? Ha, digital download with a book that can get printed at the gallery or at whatever regular, like Kinko's or whatever. Make it really easy, simple, but yes, still beautiful that they can just go to the art shop at their local artist-run center or a small gallery, and now you have this album and you have a physical thing. And because unless I get really massive distribution, but for massive distribution, you have to sign your music away to a label. And I'm not ready to do that. I'm not ready to give control to a big label. So that's another decision that I am making. You know, I could reach out to these big labels, and then that means that my album will get released in 2 years instead of September. That'll be the one thing. And secondly, you know, you give them your masters. I'm not ready to do that, you know, and I don't have the patience to pursue a label that will fit to what I need. That's a true issue that we have to deal with in music. It's like you need the protection of a label, whatever money that they give you up front, but they will have control and they will want you to go on tour when they want you to go on tour and all these things. So for me to be able to keep up with my lifestyle, I have to have control. And that means if I'm going to work with a label, it's going to be with a label that's going to do it my way.
Have you ever thought about starting your own label?
A lot of people tell me that they say that I will be great at it, but I think I will, but when I'm like in my 40s or my 50s.
You have a lot of future plans.
Yeah, I just don't see myself performing forever and ever. I think that I will probably release music, but I won't be touring it or anything like that. But I do see I see myself as someone that sees talent and gives platform to new talent. I see myself as a teacher. I see myself as a teacher. And I would love to run my own label one day and that be what I do.
A lot from young artists and cultural workers about the process of making a living from creative work. But the products they're creating are also exciting and innovative. Cultural correspondent Jesse Cumming reviews youth creativity in music, film, visual art, literature, and design. This episode, Jesse discusses the work of Toronto-based writer Jess Taylor.
Between text, Twitter, and Snapchat, our present moment can seem obsessed with the short and sweet. There is obvious value in brevity, and at times the most concise messages can be the most profound. The remarkable stories of Jess Taylor prove exactly how rich short form can be, especially when developing place and character. Though slim, her debut collection of short stories, Paul's, is a deceptively major read. Paul's follows two earlier chapbooks of poetry and a number of standalone magazine pieces. The book earned 11th place on the National Post year-end international book tally in 2015. Breakfast Curry, a highlight of the collection, was nominated for a National Magazine Award, while the lead story Paul's was awarded the earlier Gold Fiction National Magazine Award in 2013. Both stories were initially published in Little Brother, the Toronto-based magazine whose fiction section Taylor now edits. Paul's is a remarkably diverse and refined collection of writing, with each of the stories loosely linked by the name Paul, sometimes a Paulina, Polly, or just Paul. There is Paul the roommate, Paul the therapist down the street, Paul the wood chipper, Paul the academic. This isn't to suggest that the stories are at all similar. The stories shift from first person to second person to third person. Taylor has an undeniable talent for voice and character. Several of the stories revolve around young women, and Taylor explores their anxieties with precision and care. Stories can pivot between banal concerns about work, grand existential concerns of how to be a good person, or immediate anxieties about death and sexual violence. The short form of the stories frequently functions as an exercise in minimalism. Seemingly mundane details are imbued with an added heft. Taylor manages to write about daily life with a confidence and insight that ensures that the events and characters are never insignificant. What makes Paul's particularly special are the stories that move beyond these characters. Across the book, Taylor effortlessly develops and inhabits characters of various ages, genders, sexualities, professions, and temperaments. Obvious connections can be drawn between Taylor and other experts of the short form, like the empathy of the great Alice Munro. Other stories, like Breakfast Curry, recall George Saunders. With both Saunders and Taylor, there is an ability to unexpectedly drift from an understated realism to something wholly odd and unfamiliar that is presented with the same matter-of-factness. Most of the stories in Paul's hover around 20 pages, with the exception of the final 50-page story, Degenerate. The story doubles as both a successful foray into medium-length fiction writing, while also hinting at Taylor's novelistic ambitions. Set in Toronto's West End, the story follows a number of characters we've met in previously isolated stories. Taylor is adept at building worlds, narrative, and characters in mere pages, but with Degenerate, she proves her ability to place these characters into broader movements and exchanges. The result is cumulative, the emotional impact even more profound and devastating. In Degenerate, we see the ways in which past traumas and desires linger. We see the way they influence even the most innocuous daily interaction, and reconsider the small-scale stories we've already read. What lies behind them? Despite the familiar stereotype of writers secluded alone at home, Taylor has been continually invested in supporting her peers and community. In addition to her work with Little Brother, from 2012 to 2016, Taylor coordinated the Emerging Writers Series in Toronto, a monthly event for young Toronto-based writers. Recently, Taylor edited two collections of poetry. One is entitled Bafter Sea and is published by Book Thug. The other is an installment in an ongoing publication called The City Series and is focused on Toronto. The writer is preparing both a new collection of stories as well as a novel, proof that even if it serves to work in the small scale, it also serves to think big.
For information about our guests, check the show notes for this episode or our website, everydaywearehustling.com. Everyday We're Hustling is produced by Jesse Cumming. Our program is recorded and edited by Max Cotter, with graphic and web design by Lacey Woke, and music by Adam Wado. I'm your host, Marietta Campbell, assistant professor in the School of Creative Industries at Ryerson University. Everyday We're Hustling is funded by the Creative Innovation Grant at Ryerson University.